Thanks for coming on Monday night. We're glad to see you all. We're going to continue our study this evening that we began yesterday afternoon, followed through yesterday evening, and want to continue each night this week, and that is the study of Balaam and his parables from the book, from the chapters rather, 22 through 24 of the book of Numbers. I'm going to ask you to turn this evening to chapter 23 of the book of Numbers. Perhaps I should say, for those of you who are here this evening, were not here yesterday, that next week we are going to put the chart on the Revelation up here and commence the study of it, which will be terminated in the South Main Assembly. We're going to pick up the first three chapters here next week, and then move it over to South Main and start the following Lord's Day for chapters 4 through 22. This week we are on the parables of Balaam. Let's read from chapter 23. Perhaps we should go back a little bit into 22 and read from verse 37 or verse 36. When Balak heard that Balaam was come, he went out to meet him unto the city of Moab, which is in the border of Arnon, which is in the utmost coast. And Balak said unto Balaam, Did I not earnestly send unto thee to call thee? Wherefore camest thou not unto me? Am I not able indeed to promote thee to honor? And Balaam said unto Balak, Lo, I am come unto thee. Have I now any power at all to say anything? Notice that and underline it in your mind. When you're considering the character of Balaam, his ability, his prophetic office, his influence with spirits, his capacity as a spirit medium, remember that a medium, someone who deals with spirits, who communicates in necromancy with the dead, or who brings to you some message from the outer world. Remember, he is not a source of the information. Have I now any power at all to say anything? Previously he had said, The word that Jehovah speaks unto me, that will I speak. You see, he is but a tool. He is only an instrument in the hands of higher power. And we must remember that, particularly in the parables that we are here to consider. The word that God, that is Elohim, who commented on this title yesterday and how that it is not a restricted title, it is not used exclusively for God, it is also used for the God of the heathen, and it is used even at times for men in a position of elevation. So when he says the word that God or Elohim put in my mouth, that's when I speak, he's not saying anything more than he could have said on another occasion. Verse 39, And Balaam went with Balak, and they came unto Kirjath-Huzoth. And Balak offered oxen and sheep, and sent to Balaam and to the princes that were with him. And it came to pass in the morrow that Balak took Balaam and brought him up into the high places of Baal, that thence he might see the utmost part of the people, or the fringe, that is. Chapter 23, Balaam said unto Balak, Build me here 7 altars, and prepare me here 7 oxen and 7 rams. And Balak did as Balaam had spoken. And Balak and Balaam offered on every altar a bullock and a ram. And Balaam said unto Balak, Stand by thy burnt offering, and I will go. Peradventure, perhaps, hopefully, who knows? The Lord, Jehovah, that is the God of Israel, will come to meet me, and whatsoever he showeth me, I will tell thee. And he went to an high place. God met Balaam, and said unto him, I have prepared 7 altars, and I have offered upon every altar a bullock and a ram. And Jehovah, the Lord, put a word in Balaam's mouth, and said, Return unto Balak, and thus shalt thou say, and thus shalt thou speak. And he returned unto him, and lo, he stood by his burnt sacrifice, he and all the princes of Moab. And he took up his parables, and said, Balak the king of Moab hath brought me from Aram, out of the mountains of the east, saying, Come, curse me Jacob, and come defy his death. How shall I curse whom God hath not cursed? Or how shall I defy whom the Lord hath not defied? For from the top of the rocks I see him,
and from the hills I behold him. Lo, the peoples shall dwell alone and shall not be reckoned among the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob and the number of the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the righteous, and let my last end be like his. Balak said unto Balaam, What hast thou done unto me? I took thee to curse mine enemies, and behold, thou hast blessed them altogether. And he answered and said, Must I not take heed to speak that which the Lord Jehovah hath put in thy mouth? Well, that's the fight for reading tonight. Let me just take a minute or two to remind you of the man whose words we are listening to, and we are going to ponder a little this evening. We noticed yesterday his origin. He came out of the east, the land of light. We noticed his profession. He was a notorious prophet of considerable success. We noticed something of his character. He was, above all, a very avaricious man. Very covetous, driven with a compelling drive for gold. We noticed he was a very persistent man, stubbornly persistent. And we noticed as well that he was a seer, one who's supposed to see beyond the normal and the natural, and couldn't see as far as his beasts of burden saw. There are three words in the New Testament that are used in the passages we read last evening in the Gospel meeting to refer to this man, and there are three words in the Old Testament in the passages we have read to describe what he tried to do. In the New Testament, we read first of all about the way of Balaam, then we read about the error of Balaam, and finally we read about the doctrine of Balaam. The way of Balaam we have touched on briefly. He is a man who was impelled, who was driven by a force not only for notoriety and fame, but also fortune. His way was that he would make everything else subordinate to that goal. Well, everybody has plans in life. Everybody has a target. Everybody has an ambition. Everybody has a goal. You look back over the last 10 years and you say, well, what have I done? Did I get to where I was going? Did I acquire what I wanted to acquire? Have I been what I wanted to be? And we all more or less have goals. We have ambitions. We have ends. We have projects and plans. At least I think most of us do. And people are drifting, I guess. They don't seem to have any interest in anything of any definitive nature in their life. But most of us have plans. Most of us have ambitions. We have a way. We have a call that we set ourselves off. And Balaam had a call. He already, as I said, had attained considerable notoriety. He was very famous. He was known away over in what today is the land of Jordan, from away over in the land of Iran, beyond the Mesopotamian basin. He was known for his very successful ventures into the spirit world. He was known because what he said came to pass. What he promised was fulfilled. But there was more to it than that. I see underlying the search for fortune, also the search for fame. Balak, it wasn't just casually that he mentioned where he read tonight, that he could honor this man. And everything, that's one of Balaam's ambitions was, to be with the elite. To have his place, to move in the upper circle, with the, what do you call it? Brass, the high brass, the top brass, or the polished brass, or some kind of brass. I know they've got a lot of brass, mostly it's all green. At any rate, you get right up there in the upper echelons, and you're moving with society's elite. He died with kings all around him. So he got where he was going that way. But it wasn't a very noble end. He was a man who had a purpose. He was a man whose way was of that character. But we read about last evening about the error of Balaam. He made a tremendous mistake. You know what it was? He didn't understand the God of Israel. He didn't understand the character of the God that he was dealing with. Now remember, he's a man that's dealing with the God. He's a man that has to do with spirit. He's a man that steps out of the materialistic world in which most of us are living. He's a man that goes beyond the mundane. beyond the earthly, and is more than that. He's a man that has his conversation, his communications, and his customs with the God. And this was his error. He knew that the gods of the people whom he had cursed before, he commented a little bit yesterday, I scared some of you, about the power of the unseen world to curse. We should never underestimate the power of the spirit world to affect the life and destiny of men on earth. I think I did suggest to you this afternoon that the events of earth are foretold and planned in heaven, not necessarily God's heaven. Many of the momentous events, the great deeds of earth, are spirit-inspired and spirit-directed, because the blunders sometimes, as well as the tremendous and unexpected successes of the movement of men and nations, both militarily and politically, are not due to either man's ignorance, or his blindness, or his expertise. Oftentimes they are due to a direct intervention from the spirit world. Remember, my friend, we have a vital link with the spirit world, for each of us has a spirit. And because we have a body, we live in this world. Because we have a soul, we know who we are living in this world. But because we have a spirit, we have a means, a medium to communicate with the other world. And there is a spirit in man which is the candle of the Lord. And that spirit that we have is the point of contact between God and us. But by the same truth, our spirit also can be the point of contact between us and other spirits. When we come to study the book of the Revelation, we probably will see that the unseen world is nearly as far away as we think it is. But the netherworld, as we call it, the infernal world, is only a step away. And that the spirit world in the heavenly is within reach of any and all. And you see, the New Testament tells us that there's going to be a very definite danger in the times in which we are living now. You know what it is? It's the ability and the possibility of giving heed to producing spirit. And in 1 John chapter 4, we read that we are to test or try the spirit, because there are many of them gone out into the world, moving men to teach doctrines, to plan campaigns, to form societies, even to build churches, if you please. I recently read of a man who wanted to make his fortune in a hurry, so he decided, after he analyzed the whole economic situation, the best way and effective way to become a millionaire was to start a new church. He did it, and became it. And it's simply fantastic. I say to my wife oftentimes, when this bulk of unsolicited literature comes through the mail and lands on our floor, unfortunately, when I'm away, my secretary gathers it all up and sorts it all out, and let's go up to the least release, and let's be close out, and it's been a tremendous amount of time. You can't do that without financial resources. And I, being a printer, often pick up pieces of literature come through my mailbox, and I look at it and I say, $4 job, holding stock, etc., etc. That really cost somebody a lot of money. I know. Because I know what holding stock costs. And I know what plasticizing your printing costs. And I know what, setting it up costs. And I know what, four-color jobs cost. And I know color separation. And I know what you have to do to make the four names and to run the four place and so on and so forth. And I say, how can I do it? I'm going to get rich quick, get out in the church. So we have behind a number of things that we can't see beyond the surface, which are none, no more nor less than the product of the activity of the spirit world. And he's only a dreamer who thinks that he just has a body and a mind, and this is all there is, and when it's done, we're finished. He's a dream. He's a man who's not with at all. He's not even aware of what unchristian, unbelieving, and even sometimes agnostic and atheistic men realize. There's something out there. And we are the party. So you get books like The Chariots of the Gods and so on that are being produced, and films that are being produced, and you have all sorts of specters and ogres and so on coming into our movie world and into our literature world and into our educational fields. But it's all reflecting a reality. There is a world out there. Not only the God that we know, but the gods of Balaam too. He had his below him, you see. And when he is called upon to curse the people of Israel, he said, well, the first thing I've got to do is get in touch with their God. For if I can get in touch with their God, influence with the God means influential in arranging the destiny of the people. So if you want to hurt the people, you can't do it militarily, as Balak confesses he can. Then find their God. And so, this man comes in search of additional faith. We read about the error of Balaam, though. His way was that he loved the wages of unrighteousness. His error was twofold. He thought, as you noticed last night, that God would lend himself and give permission to Balaam to destroy a people just because their enemy wanted it. Apart from all sense of justice, righteousness, morality. That's a mistake. The second mistake he made was this. He thought there was a way in which God would bend his principles, change his mind, alter his statement, and thereby have his purposes frustrated. That was his aim. And finally, we read in Revelation chapter 2 of the doctrine of Balaam. I'll have more to say to that when we come to the last parable, but just let me say this at any rate. The doctrine of Balaam is seen on every side of us today, in church circles, in social circles, in moral circles, and elsewhere. The doctrine of Balaam is this. There are two areas of man, and these two areas of man must be invaded in order to destroy it. The one area is the physical, and the other area is the spiritual. If you can invade these two areas of man, you can destroy it. Get him into some kind of contamination, physically. Get him into a sphere of defilement, spiritually, and you've ruined it. That's Balaam's doctrine. As I said, each of us has a body and a spirit. The body is that in which we move around in the physical, material world. The spirit is that with which we have contact and communication with the spirit world. We're affected by the product of work. If I can be contaminated physically, and if I can be defiled spiritually, I am totally a shambles. Well, you better understand it. Alright. Then let me be very forthright and practical. What are the two things that contaminate the body and defile the spirit? Simply this. Illicit, unlawful, immoral relationships. How do you get that way? Well, in the case of Balaam here, we'll talk to him later on if he thought that with this, gets the people into a sexual mix-up. Gets them with their enemies, with the Midianites, into promiscuity, sexual promiscuity. How free sex do you call it today? For Mrs. Spencer, I'm really tough. I was talking to a girl last week going to high school, and I said to her, your high school wrote has really got a bad name for smoking. Yeah, that's good too, because, you know, your high school had a bad name for, drugs. No, she said, as far as I know, there's nobody, not on the grounds anyway. Are either pushing it or using it. Great. Hey, tell me, how about sex? and everything for this. And she, I think by this time the wheels were going around, she said, hey, maybe this guy knows more than he knows. So, and this is not an old square, like I thought he liked to be, you know. And she kind of hesitated, well, she said, I guess that's another story. I said, yeah? How? Well, we talk about it all the time, yeah. And in that dirty, low sort of way, yeah. And, it's everywhere, yeah. And everybody's mixed up in it, yeah. Well, look, just a second now. I want to know something. If they're real smoking out and they're real drug dealers, then that's two lethal enemies to get rid of. Tell me, how come that sex has such a big place? You know, they talk about it as though it's something new that just discovered in our generation. Well, not mine, the younger one. And of course, it's been around ever since Adam and Eve did, as far as I know. I don't know of any time period when it was eliminated, but anyway. There must be something very unusually important about this. When I come to my Bible, I discover that it has a very large place in the Scripture. And I discover that there's a very distinct purpose for that. It's one of the major provisions that God has made for the happiness of man. Let's ruin it. And I discover when I come to Balaam that that was one of his very subtle modes or tactics whereby he almost destroyed a people that by divine inspiration he said were invincible. That's a contradiction, isn't it? How can you destroy somebody that's invincible? Well, he didn't. But he almost did. And the second thing is an illicit relationship in the spirit, in the world of the spirit. When you say, I don't have anything to do with spiritism. I don't believe in seances. I don't believe in anything like that from the horoscope of the Ouija board up to necromancy. I don't have anything to do with that at all. Do you think that's the only way your spirit can be defined? What's the nearest physical organ to a man's spirit? His mind. What goes into the mind? Things you see, things you hear, things you read. I was at a country place a while back, and there was a lot of young people there. Oh, I don't know, 150 or so. And one day, I was walking across the ground, and I saw a group down here, and they were out in canoes, or boating. And over yonder on a volleyball court, there was a whole gang of them there playing volleyball. Teenagers and early married. And out here in the field, there were two teams lined up and they were playing football. And down in the foreground, there were some of them and they had these hot air balloons made out of tissue paper, you know, and they were lighting fires. And I walked into a building behind me, opened the door, and there was a big auditorium, upstairs, and so forth. There was a couple up the front. And I had been talking to them, I knew that they were engaged to be married shortly. He was playing the violin, and she was playing the flute. And they were playing Bach, she said. And I stood and listened to him for a while, and I listened to him for a while. And I said, now, let's put this thing together. Canoeing, volleyball, football, air balloon, and Bach. All the laughter and goings on down there in the lake, and all the shouting that carry on over the volleyball court, and the scrimmages and the running around in the football field, and the fires and enthusiasm over the air balloon, didn't mean a thing. But this guy and his gal, he's just saying practical music. So I commented to some of them later on, and I said, look, this is what I saw. And they said to me, you know what? Those two kids get as much or more enthusiasm and delight out of playing ball as the other two playing volleyball or paddling a canoe or playing football. Now then, When I put this all together, what conclusion do I come to? Every man feeds on something. Everybody's got something that he responds to, that thrills them. The spirit is fed as much as the body is fed. You can do it by music. You can do it by literature. You can do it by art. You can do it by contact with the spirit. You can do it by dreams. You can do it by laughing. We can experience spirit contamination without touching a member of the spirit world at all. Just eagerly devour something that they produce. Right? How would that go for some of the music we've got around today? I said, terribly, music. I'm not sure exactly what it really is. How about the lyrics of some of this music? What are we doing? We are absorbing a communication from somebody to us. Where did it come from? Well, I asked you where it came from. Who produced it? Oh, he's just a brilliant songwriter. Well, dazzling is a better word. When you see some of the gyrations, not to mention the lyrics, you did get dazzling. In fact, you did geometrically bamboozle. You did even follow the, they take one of these electronic sensors to mark the movements, all that. Where does this stuff come from? You see, we can be contaminated in the spirit. That's what they do, and we're contaminated in the body. Fornication, I don't care by whom, with whom, when or how, is physical contamination. And by the same token, spiritual contamination is contracted through the medium of the mind that receives the product of the spirit world. Be it art, literature, music, whatever it is. Or a little closer than that. Now then. The whole purpose is this, to destroy the man that was made in the image of God. Nobody gets away with anything anywhere at any time. Did you read the Time magazine on herpes recently? Did you see that article? Well, he said yes, but he said no. Well, you know, you get a cold from your mouth, that's herpes. And you get some kind of infected, internal disease. And one of the producers of one of our pornographic outfits today came up with this after Time's article on herpes. It looks as though somebody up there is going to call us to account for what we're doing down here. And God doesn't have to burst the skies with a lightning flash to say, whatsoever man sows, that's what it all goes. The sexual revolution is producing now its own drastic consequences. It can't handle perfect. And the blood is spread in that manner. That's the doctrine of Balaam. Ruin the man physically and ruin him spiritually and you destroy him completely. That's the instruction. We'll see more about that and how it works. It is a little wrong. There are three words used here in the book of Numbers that I want to draw your attention to in connection with what he tried to do to Israel under the instigation of Balaam. Two of them are translated in our KJV, curse. And you have it, one of them we have it three times, and the other we have nine times. Just let me show you the difference right here in chapter 23, although they come before 23. In verse 7 we read, come curse me Jacob, that's one word. And come defy Israel, that's another word. How shall I curse? That's another word. Now, there are three distinct words. Two of them are translated curse, and the other one is translated defy. The word that is translated curse in verse 7, come curse me Jacob, is only used three times in the four parables or in the whole narrative. And it means to bitterly. The word that is translated curse in verse 7, come curse me Jacob, is only used three times in the four parables or in the whole narrative. And it means to bitterly curse someone. It's a very strong word. It's only used, as I said, three times. The word in verse 8 that says, how shall I curse when God is not cursed, used twice there in first line of verse 8, is a word that's used nine times, and it means literally to stab something with words.
Oh, God. Did we get one of those stabbing? Somebody said something and went right through you and out the other side. Like a thought in those bullets. That's a big hole in the muscle. Word! The Shakespeare said, somebody said, when it might have been the saw.
Word! Who was it said,
boys flying kites, flying their white wing birds, but you can't do that when you're flying words.
Words are expressed and sometimes fall down dead. But even God
won't kill them once they're dead.
Words are tremendously effective. They hurt, they kill, they cut, they wound.
And they lay behind the stars that nothing in this life ever is. James talks about the power of the tongue. A world, he says, of iniquity.
A weapon that everybody has and few of us know how to use and wear.
He that bridles and holds his tongue to the perfect man. He that holds his whole spirit.
Yeah, but if you only knew what I'm thinking about,
well, that's all right. You're thinking about it, but just think for yourself.
Don't express what you're thinking.
Oh, I think it's too much. I think we should express ourselves. This is a day of self-expression.
Yeah, what kind of day is it? I'm asking.
And then you talk about that.
Well, I've been to the psychiatrist several times because I got this major problem, Dave. You know I have. Yeah, I know you have. And you know what he's told me? Boy, girls, and saying not to do one for this week. He has told me, listen, what you've got to do is say, tell the people what you're thinking.
You know, one of the fruits of the spirit is self-control. One of the products of psychiatry is no control. Every psychiatrist needs one anyway.
That one does that. It's just about number one on the list of suicides now.
Yeah. Our world's on mess.
We don't even know how to handle it. You know, I was flying in Air Canada a while back, and I pulled up their little magazine in the seat in front of me en route called. And I read an article, and boy, it stopped me cold. I said, there's a message for a few sermons. This guy's even a Christian. You know what he said? He said, the problem with our day is not economics, but culture. It's not the standard of living, it's the quality of life.
I don't know anybody can say any better.
Standard of living!
Oh, no.
Hey, what a living.
And that's not
it. You know our house is quadri-level? You're kidding. I thought 5 levels was lovely.
Oh, no, 4 levels is enough.
A man took me to his home a while ago and said, hey, the watch is through my house.
Yeah,
sure. Did you come home for dinner? I said, sure, glad to. You know what he did? Took me in the front door, took me off to the side.
Now he said, this is the den, and this is the living room, and this is upstairs, and upstairs he saw
8 bedrooms and 7 bathrooms. I'm not kidding. And by the time I went through those, I didn't even know where I was. I couldn't have found my way back up to the front door. I'd been left all alone. I'd been gone. So he took me down through some stairs and down into this dining area. You know. There's a kitchen over there. Boy, everything's tiny, it's in the steel, all and more and kitchen. I looked around and then, I couldn't see a bit of both things or screaming on. I mean, is that anywhere? And I said, you're always going to ask me to give thanks. And oh, yes. I can't see a thing. And I'll be feeling like Bobby Burns. You know Bobby Burns when he was sitting down at the table and he had all the crystal and the silver on.
You couldn't see anything. He said, you know, Burns did his thanks. And he
looked around and said to him, thou who didst bless the loaves and fishes, look upon these bits of dishes. And if thou canst our stomach fill, thou work a wondrous miracle. I felt like that, you know. And he showed me all this feeling. I thought, huh? Now he said, we're going out for dinner. We're going out for dinner. But man, you had to show me that house. Talk about standard of living.
So what's the quality of life?
What kind of life are we living? We're living uneasy, unhappy, disturbed, bad-tempered, etc., etc., etc. And that man wrote in Maritime Magazine, he just put his finger right on it. He said, it's not the standard of living, it's the quality of life. We've got to do this today. Now look, Micah, that's exactly what we're handling here. We are those whom God has made in His image, and He's made us for His pleasure and our happiness. And there are three words that are used here. One is to stab a man with words. That word is used 9 times in Balaam's text. And that's exactly what he's determined to do. He's going to stab this nation of Israel full of holes with words. He's going to put a curse upon them. Also translated to imprecate or execrate, to curse. And the other word that we have here in verse 8, how shall I despise when the Lord shall despise? Is the word to bruise, to oppose, to batter. Now, those are the three words that we have here. Alright. Balaam comes and he meets Balak. And Balak's already got the altars all built and the sacrifices on them. These are all the sacrifices. Why do you do that? Balak did that on his own. That's verse 40, chapter 26. When Balaam arrives at the verse of chapter 23, he says to Balak, I want you to build me 7 altars. What's that for? To get in contact with Jehovah. Who's Jehovah? The God of that nation down there. You want me to stab with my word. Build me 7 altars. I want you to offer on every altar a bullock and a ram. Balak responds. We build 7 altars. We offer 10 sacrifices at every altar, 14 sacrifices. And what's this all for? He said, I'm going out to meet Jehovah. I'm going to move out into the spirit world. I'm going to contact the God of Israel. Maybe. Peradventure, perhaps, hopefully, the God of Israel meets. If he doesn't meet me and you can't defeat that people militarily, I can't defeat them spiritually. I've got to get in contact with the God of Israel. Now, build me these altars, so he did it. Now I want you to know something. He had no assurance whatsoever that God would meet. He isn't doing it God's way anyway. The Lord never said build 7 altars and offer 14 sacrifices. God told his people where he would meet with them and how he would meet with them. And that's not the way. But he doesn't know. He's doing the best he knows. The gods must be appeased. Tell me, my friend, how do you expect to get in contact with God? You ever try to pray and didn't get anywhere? You ever try to put yourself up into heaven and run down back here and really get off there? You ever try to make some kind of contact with God? I read in my Bible, he that comes to God. You come, you cross an area of distance between you and God. Well, how do you get over that area? Is it geographical? No. What is it? It's moral and spiritual. I come to God. Can I get in contact with God? Paul told the philosophers at Athens in Acts chapter 17, you know what? God isn't far from any one of us. You're lucky. You can feel out touching. He said, feel. He said, you're getting a little bit visionary now. Haven't you got any vision? Are you a materialist? A humanist? Do you think everything's to do with man down here? You don't have any contact, any touch with that other world? Can I get into contact with God? Will He speak with me? Can I speak to Him? And I know I can speak to Him. How do I get there? Balaam says, I want 7 altars and 14 sacrifices. And I'll gloat, perhaps, maybe, hopefully, over God of Israel in me. Would you like to live in an uncertainty like that all your life? Not me. I don't want to have an uncertain relationship with God. I don't want to say, well, I hope the Lord will send me to heaven when I die. Not that I don't know for sure.
Isn't it right to know for sure that you belong to the Lord?
Cool. It's magnificent. And it's a present reality. That's most of the people here tonight, and they'll tell you that.
I'm going out.
And he's your host.
So he went out, and what happened? Elohim met him.
That's what we read in verse 4.
And when the God of Israel met Balaam, Balaam says, I've done this. Did you notice the free way that he talks with God? And you notice the way the Lord answers him? But you kind of sounded at that. And you say, well, this man must have been a Christian. This man must have been a believer. This man must have been a son of God. Because he talks to the Lord and the Lord talks back to him. Listen.
He talked to lots of spirits before this time. And they talked back to him. He's been doing this for years. He's practiced at this. This isn't something brand new like might happen to you tonight.
Oh, no. This is Salem's sphere of operation. This is his life. This is what he does all the time. It's not a dramatic thing for Balaam when Elohim, the God of Israel, meets him to say, look, I've built 7 altars and I've offered my sacrifices.
There's nothing unusual about that with a man like this.
Don't let that fool you. Don't let that make you think that this man Balaam is a true prophet, for he's not.
But he has contact with the spirit world. He's done this before many times.
And as far as he's concerned, this is just another set of God belonging to another nation, and he's been dealing with God for years.
The Lord asked him.
And he says, look, go back to Balak, and this is the way you're going to speak. That's the first thought. So he comes up. And what does he do? Takes up the first parable, and he says, Balak, the king of Moab, brought me from Aram out of the mountains of the east. He touched on identity, and he said, come curse me, Jacob, and come defy his wrath. The first thing that I want you to know and to notice with me is the use of the terminology when he refers to the people of God. I'm going to call this the unification of the people of God. That's just verse 2. The unification. Every time he talks about the people, he always uses the double title. Jacob. What he might say about the one, he must say about the other. Let me say that to you again. What Balaam might say about Jacob, he must say about Israel. 8 times in the 4 parables, he refers to the nation as Jacob and Israel. Always with a double title. What does that mean? It teaches us a very important lesson that we might have forgotten. And what's that? God doesn't look at his people and consider them like this audience is tonight, divided into 2 sets. Jacob? What does Jacob mean?
Oh, it means a supplanter. That is, or someone that took somebody else's lot or part or inheritance or something or whatever.
And what does Israel mean?
Israel means a prince, a God.
When you say Jacob, what do you think of? 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. 40 years of stubbornness. 40 years of rebellion. 40 years of a people who just don't seem to know where they're going. Cranky, critical, caustic, rebellious. You name it. There it is. For 40 years, why God said to them, 10 times you provoked me in the wilderness. He even said, you know what? When you offered your sacrifice, you didn't even offer them to God. Not Jehovah the God of Israel. You offered your sacrifice in the wilderness for 40 years to Moloch, the God of the heathen. Remember that.
The God of the idolatry.
Jacob. Who's Jacob?
Conniving, twisted, subtle, deceitful, stubborn, persistent, obstinate, astute. Old merchant.
Oh, I like the old man. Oh,
Of course, what I'm saying now, at any rate, is true of the nation, not of their father Jacob, who's dead long ago. The name now is applied to the nation. And they're called Jacob. And when you think of Jacob, all you think of is the season, okay? When you think of Israel, what do you think of? And that wrestled with God all night. One. Anybody here have that experience yet? You don't think that's a remarkable thing? He just tried praying all night. Let alone wrestling with an angel all night. He tried to pray all night? I guess he had. Probably he had. I tried to pray defense. I never got through the first watch. I found too many places to scratch and too many things to think about. And another thing going through my mind, I didn't pray for an hour, steady, let alone pray all night. And Jacob, he wrestled with an angel all night. And became Israel. Israel! A prince of Israel. Look. It's the same nation. Don't split it. God doesn't look at his people and say, oh, that's just the old man. Look, you know. That's it. That's just the old nation. This is the mean interest in him. God doesn't look at his people that way. He doesn't say, well, he's got a bad temper, but that's the old nature. I'll have to forgive him because he has the divine seed in him too. And, you know, he's my child. But that part over there, I don't have anything to do with that. You know, I used to think for years, what in the world's going to happen when the Lord comes and all goes to heaven and the old nature left behind? I wonder how big my deep father is. Because I was taught and I was made to believe that there was one part of me was the old nature, another part of me was the new nature, and the old nature never did anything right, and the new nature never did anything wrong, and you couldn't do anything with this, and neither with God, so he rejected it totally out of hand, and this, of course, is perfect, and the Lord just thinks it's wonderful, and he's bringing it up into the image of his son, and that's Jacob over there, and this is Israel over here, and that's no good, and this is all good. And so, I had myself split right down the middle. I was a spiritual Jesus clinic. There's Dr. Jekyll over here, Dr. Hyde over here. And, Lord, you know, after all, I couldn't help it, Lord. I mean, my dad had a bad temper before me, and I just let it go. I'm sorry, Lord, you know, and, but you know, that's just the old nature, Lord. And after all, hey, that's not right. Everything you say about Jacob, you have got to say about Jacob. Watch it all the way through. 8 times it comes up. So then, he's going to talk about Jacob, and he's going to talk about Israel. Come, search me, Jacob. Come, defy me, Israel. All one and the same unit. Well, I just loved that when I found it first. I hope you do too tonight. Listen, let me say this to you. When God accepted me, he accepted all of me. When he saved me all. Oh, no, the body. What's wrong with the body? It's just the material, it's not worth anything. Listen, it's an integral part of man designed to represent God. And you must not discredit, discount, or despise it. Defile it, and you suffer the consequences. Use it, and you suffer the consequences. But the Lord saved my soul. The Lord saved you. How about my soul is safe? Well, safer than your body. How about my body can get sick? So can your soul. How about my body can be defiled? So can your spirit. Your body is no worse off. Your soul is no safer than your body. God has purchased you all by the blood of the whole man. And I pray, God, that your whole spirit, soul and body as a unit to reserve payment and the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, as the Paul said in 1 Thessalonians 5. Let us banish from our minds if we can, it's been grounding it so long, so hard that it's difficult to get rid of. This idea, God has saved my soul, praise the Lord, I care what happens to my body. You should care, because God cares. because it's in the body, and you're going to have it forever. That is, they have a body forever, at any rate. Change, transform, translate, etc. So we're going to have physical, visible, human, tangible, natural bodies forever. If we are, we're going to be in something like this forever.
Well, it'll be a three-button suit. Or two. That's really nice.
Why don't I do now? Look here. But anyway, we are going to have, we're going to be that, in that sense, we're going to be Jacob and Israel. I'm sorry, transform, but we got to get into this. That's a different goal. I want to notice for you tomorrow night just exactly what did he say about Jacob and what did he say about Israel. And when we come to the second parable, it's more marvelous even. Yes. God is all for me, and I am all for him. Your part was a Christ. Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God. You belong to him, my believer friend. My brother and sister, we are totally his. There's nothing that belongs to the world anymore. There's nothing that belongs to the devil anymore. Thank God for that. Who would want to be a Christian in spirit and a devil in body? I know some people live like it, but that doesn't seem the truth anyway. Who wants to be a church saint when you come through the door? By the time you get behind that wheel and somebody cuts you out in the road, Israel's gone and Jacob takes over, right? No, no. We are all his and we are always his. We're always his.